any size. Catch your speed, just my size. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look over his
The extravaganza continues as we take a deep dive into the tangled webs of the Spideyverse. We left off in the previous episode on the cusp of Kev the Mev ringing the bell for our third round of the best Spidey tales. So far, we've touched on such classics as The Return of the Burglar, Spider-Man vs. Wolverine, Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut, Coming Home, and Spider-Man Blue. Oh, such a good one. It was one of the first Spider-Man stories that I read. In fact, in one of the earliest episodes, episode 9, we discussed in length those 6 issues. So go back into the Cave of Solitude archives and check that out. But enough from me for now. Let's check back in with the boys as they continue. Oh, and editor's note. There are a few moments of necessary editing as the boys were literally having to switch locations as the restaurant closed, and then the mall closed. But they were going to finish this episode. So again, sit back, enjoy the ride, and don't forget to swing by your local comic shop. In this case, Cyber City Comics. Hit them up for $800 on May 30th.
Yeah, very good. Okay, boys, round 3.
All right, round
3. Kev, take it away.
So I'm kind of repeating myself, but my number 3 choice is the Master Planner Saga from Amazing Spider-Man 31 to 33. And most notably, we have the famous sequence where Peter is trapped under rubble, a mountain of rubble, and there's no way out. Aunt May, yes, the isotope that Aunt May needs to survive is 3 feet in front of him, but he can't reach it. Because this piece of heavy machinery is basically pinned him in such a way that he can't crawl out and he can't get his arm out far enough. And he's out of webs and he's under the river, essentially in a base under the river. And the river is dripping through the ceiling. And you know, at some point the water's going to come crashing through and he's going to drown as well. So it's the first of what we would see repeated many times over the decades, which is Peter is in a situation where he can't win. There's no way out. It's certain death. We saw it again in Homecoming.
Homage to great effect. Yeah. Wonderful effect.
And so as he's lying there, it's basically an issue of him discussing his life. It's like, well, you know, what's going to happen? What would J. Jonah Jameson think if I died? What would, you know, happen to my, you know, Gwen and Harry and the people he went to the college with, and you know, Flash, and you know, just one of those things where it's like he weighs everything. You know, the classic image of the faces swirling around in the air as he's thinking about what he's, all the people that would be affected by his loss and him dying, I should say. And then of course, you know, finding the strength and the reserve to overturn the stuff and get out. Is classic. To me, that's 100% Spider-Man.
Yeah. Top 5, I think, image all time of Spider-Man, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I think that's perfectly encompasses why I think subconsciously people who like Spider-Man really like the character, because he's constantly trapped under what seems to be, you know, metaphorically as the reader, like, you feel that way in life sometimes. Like, I can't get out of this thing.
Yeah.
And he's constantly, either in his personal life or as a superhero, buried under what feels like insurmountable things. Like, why bother? To the point where he says, you know what, I'm going to keep fighting. Mm-hmm. And that it's almost like a Spider-Man trope to have him stuck under something. Because I remember seeing that in an issue of Spectacular Spider-Man when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I think the She-Hulk can throw him in a pit with, like, a lid on top of him, but he had to. It was almost the exact same thing, and I'm like,
oh yeah, they've returned to that imagery over
tons
and over
of times.
Again.
I didn't realize it until I was older, and I'm like, oh, it goes back to this
issue.
I'm
sure somewhere there's a web page that will
show
cite
you
all
every
the times
time.
He's been crushed under a building.
Peter Parker 98. I have a whole bunch of pages from that issue, but it's John Romita Jr., John Byrne writing. It's just before they relaunched it with a new direction. So So Peter is trapped under, and he's holding a building. The Daily Bugle building is blown up, and all these people are in New York, and he's basically holding the building, and he can't get out. It's almost like Prometheus or whatever that character is, holding the weight of the world.
Atlas.
Atlas, yes.
Which is an interesting image, because Ditko was a big Ayn Rand fan, right?
That's
and
true.
She wrote Atlas Shrugged, so to have Spider-Man holding the globe like that would kind of be a
there is
of the hat.
University dissertation that you could write around that.
Yeah, right.
The connection. Now, this is interesting in terms of our initial discussions. I think I threw out whether or not we should exclude 33 as well, because that could have been... It was close to making my list, but based on our discussions on whether to leave it in or include it, you mentioned... So I just presumed that you would bring it up, so I kind of shuffled it off to my honorable mention list. But would that have made your top five, for example, Eric?
You know what? There's a lot of, like...
Because I just assumed automatically it's such... an iconic issue that it would have been in all.
Yeah, like there's a bunch of
or most hardcore fans would cite it.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff like that that I was thinking. That's all, that you know. That's definitely there. Spider-Man No More is definitely there.
Yeah, again, I gave Spider-Man No More some thought as well.
Yeah, but I figured if it would be mentioned, it should come from you guys because you would have a little bit more of the connection to it. I read it now in omnibus form.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Collected form, where you guys will have a little bit more.
I think
of like,
I read it in Marvel Tales.
Yeah, see, it goes back to at least the time of youth where you're discovering the classic things of the character.
Yeah.
Where I saw that secondhand in like a Spectacular Spider-Man 200 or something, right? So it's not the same.
Yeah, well, it is kind of fascinating just discussing this as well, because you are reading a lot of these in trade paperback. Kevin and I, as kids, would read the issue that came out, and the only chance would be to catch it again when Marvel Tales went around the horn, so to speak, because it would like catch up to present day almost, or
yeah, at one
not
point
quite
they reached
day.
A point where it was almost concurrent. Maybe 2 years behind,
and then they jumped back to the. I remember distinctly they
were
jumping back to the beginning.
Marvel Tales 137 or something. Oh, 237, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
It was to go back and start with AF-15 and go forward again, and to reread those again. After, even though I had them in paperbacks, and even though I had some of the trade paperbacks that collected some of the stories, like Origins of Marvel Comics and stuff, but
I really felt like I was rediscovering Ditko during that period when they did kind of do the jump back to the beginning and the digest too. Wait, no.
So the paperbacks came out a few years before Marvel Tales.
Okay.
Yeah. So they did
the pocketbooks, right?
Yeah. And they did a ton of Marvel reprints in those pocketbooks.
Yeah, yeah.
There were five volumes of Spider-Man ones.
Those were phenomenal.
They didn't do the whole run, I think, unfortunately.
Yeah. But to me, they even read fine. Like, I know ideally you should read them in the comic page format, but the fact that they sort of cut the panels up into bite-sized chunks for the paperback format, I still consumed and love those. And again, the Fireside reprints, the bigger than comic book size Fireside reprints were on nice paper was a luxury.
But they didn't
well.
Do everything. They just did a couple stories here or there.
Now, so. Do you remember the Digest, the Spider-Man Digest? What were they reprinting in those? I'm trying to remember. I remember picking up the Digest. And again, that was a discovery going... Was it the Remedia era they jumped to?
I don't remember the Digest, to be honest.
Oh, okay. It was around the same time, I think, G.I. Joe. They were printing G.I. Joe, Spider-Man, and...
Right, they did some black and white ones. They did an X-Men one. But yeah, I don't remember.
Oh, that's right, the X-Men ones. I do like collecting the little pocketbooks, as they call them. So I have a little collection of those, and because everything's so readily available in other formats, I never get to pull these out anymore, other than admire them on my shelf.
Yeah, that's why doing these top five lists sometimes are good. You dig through the boxes and the shelves and see what you loved once upon a time.
Was the Masterworks a great day for you? When those came out?
Yeah, I love my Marvel Masterworks.
Were you on board right away? Because for me, they were so expensive, and I just coveted them, but never...
No, I think I was at university when they started doing the Masterworks, and I just never got into them at the time. And then I went back So when they re-released them with the silver and black trade dress, that's when I started buying Masterworks. Mm. And so now I have all the Masterworks, like all 200 volumes or whatever it is.
Do you prefer reading in a Masterworks or an omnibus? I know Masterworks are smaller and more, you know.
I like the Masterwork format, but I do like my omnibuses too.
Yeah.
And I like my epic collections.
Yeah.
So with Spider-Man, I have them in all three formats.
Yeah.
I've gone digital. So even going back to find things for this episode, I did it digitally.
Much easier.
Yeah, otherwise I'd have to go to my storage locker, you know, who knows where things are buried on my shelves right now, or in bins or in long boxes.
Right.
Digital is just, you know, right at your fingertips, on your iPad.
No matter where you go.
Yeah, yeah. Be on the bus.
Yeah.
You know, or
perfect.
The,
got the whole collection with you.
Pretty much, yeah.
Pulling it from the cloud. It's
opening up my Marvel app.
Oh, there you go.
You guys can't see it, but we're going through the Marvel app right now.
So I was reading the John Byrne team-up stories.
Oh, right.
But, again, reprinted in Marvel Tales.
But if I were to go to my books, and amazing, you can see.
You got all your Masterworks.
I have all the Masterworks in here.
Nice.
Every volume. And then I just recently picked up, when there was a sale, I picked up the
I got that one on my shelf, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
So they're fun to have on the go, basically.
Yeah, you have them all the time.
Yeah.
Little comfort.
So, yeah, I've always said, if I was ever trapped on a desert island, I would want at least the Lee Ditko run with me.
So that one, yeah.
So at least the Omnibus volume.
Oh, yeah, that's the one. Okay, my number three, I'm going to go with Spectacular Spider-Man number 200, J.M. DeMatteis, or DeMatteis.
Yes.
Sal Buscema, Death of Harry Osborn.
Fantastic run.
Yeah. I mean, I feel as though if they kept J.M. DeMatteis writing Spider-Man, he would have killed everybody in Spider-Man.
Yeah, yeah, no.
But when he did it, he made it matter.
Oh, yes.
He made it count. He made you remember
for
it.
Sure,
and it affected Peter deeply.
And it was an epic storyline.
Epic story. Epic. Yeah. And to culminate it with that issue, it's an anniversary issue, but, and, you know, it's during that Hollow Foil era and all those type of things, but the last two or three pages.
That they were doing their own thing almost.
Yes, yes.
Almost allowed to do their own thing.
Yes. And just those last couple of pages, there's no words, it's just the panels, the picture, him holding Harry's hand, the hand goes lifeless, him at the hospital, Mary Jane seeing his face, knowing what's happened, and it adds so much weight to the friendship, the history, the rivalry with him and his father. If you haven't read Spectacular Spider-Man 200, you can find it in the back issue bin for pretty cheap. Pick it up, it's worth having in any collection.
The dozen or so issues leading up to it as
The whole run.
The fact that it was a slow burn.
Exactly.
I think it was,
but that's
ultimately DeMatteis' large arc on the book, like almost his
I think in a way that time Spectacular was, looking back, a more sophisticated book than the Michelinie and McFarlane run, because before that you had Conway and Buscema doing the Tombstone stuff, and it was much more of a grounded character dealing with human issues. So when it, you know, you get to 200 and a big moment like this happens in Peter's life, it's again you don't want all these characters to die off, but if it's going to happen, it's got to mean something. That one meant a lot.
And DeMatteis was one to really push the envelope.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote all kinds of different stuff. The guy who gave us Wahaha
Justice League. Yeah.
Justice League also was doing stuff like Moonshadow at the time, or even Blood, or Greenberg the Vampire. Very sort of sophisticated, adult storytelling.
Psychological, like Kraven's Last Hunt.
Not adult in the underground comic sense, but like, you know, grown up stuff. Like a fairy tale for adults, I think, was what they built Moonshadow as. But then the sophistication he layered on to Peter and his supporting cast. And I think he was allowed to do that because Kraven's Last Hunt gave him a lot of license, but just being on the I think those that get the side book often are able to just run and do their own things. They often get quirkier characters.
Yeah.
But for him to take ownership of Harry Osborn, Green Goblin, was a real coup, I think.
Yeah, I think so,
and,
too.
And without interference from the main amazing title, which has always been, to me, the action-adventure, you know, the standard middle-of-the-road
things. The popcorn.
Yeah, whereas the... Not that there isn't great popcorn and great action-adventure and great emotional moments that show up and amazing, but spectacular, I just all the odd, quirky stuff. And again, I've got picks.
I think that definitely did show that spectacular could be... could be a number one book.
Yes.
Because up until that point, I think there was a real amazing is the book.
Yeah.
The other ones are, if you're a Spider-Man fan, you're going to buy these other ones.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. You
know, with an added emphasis on the supporting cast. I like the fact that in say DeMatteis's or Buckingham or not sorry Jenkins and Buckingham. And Peter David and Buckler, they were allowed to do a little more with their own little, here's our sandbox. And this is why Spectacular always had the weird, quirky villains as well, right?
Yeah.
For the most part, like, real oddballs would, from the very beginning, too, right?
Yeah.
Well, you had Stern, and you had Peter David, and then you had Conway again, and then DeMatteis. It's a good cast of writers.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's a bit of an underrated, forgotten book because of what was happening in Amazing with Venom and McFarlane being the new hotshot.
Yeah.
But looking back, it holds up.
And quietly allowed to do whatever they wanted outside of whatever big continuity or big storylines or crossovers, I think.
Yeah. It's worth going back to check out Spectacular Spider-Man in the early day, or in that during that era. Your run.
Oh, number three. Here's me having my cake and eating it too. Because we set rules, because otherwise there's just going to be a lot of even more stuff. So I think we kind of said, okay, let's stick mostly to Peter Parker centric stories, and then in 616 or Ultimate Continuity, and so the What Ifs, the Spider-Man Noir, the Spider-Man Reigns, great storylines, but we'll just overlook those and focus on the ones that are, and again, I'm doing finger quotes, in continuity.
Right.
I am choosing Spider-Verse. Again,
I like
a Peter Parker-driven continuity where I get all my What Ifs and get to include, you know, Spider-Man Noir, Doc Ock, the Superior Spider-Man.
I love
Spider-Ham, which I loved as a kid. The puns, the terrible puns of them just sitting. I'm sure they must have had a field day just coming up with, you know, the Green Gobbler or Captain America Cat, Captain America Cat or Iron Mouse. Mary Jane Water Buffalo. anyways, I'm digressing again. But, getting all these what-ifs and every single Spider-Man you can think of, and we talked about my fist-pumping moment of Leo Pardon showing up from my childhood memories of the Spider-Man TV show. But it also did a lot of other things, too, which is a very strong Peter Parker-centric story where he got to do something that was different than the average thing. It was epic in scope, and by far, I think, the most epic and satisfying of Dan Slott. Like, it's hard to pick amongst... His run is so great. He's got
ten years.
Bits. But for me, the culmination was Spider-Verse.
He added a lot of spokes to the Spider-Man universe,
and he really was
right?
firing on all cylinders, able to handle multiple, like, he was juggling chainsaws, balancing on a bowling ball. Like, this was bravura stuff he was doing in Spider-Verse as well. We've talked about our love of that initial JMS, J. Michael Straczynski, storyline that introduced Moreland and Ezekiel. And I always, to me, it's unfortunate, which is very much a lot of Straczynski stuff. He doesn't quite stick the landing. He's introduced this wonderful, terrifying villain, and then where did it go from there?
Yeah.
You know, so Slott, and I believe it's Slott, introduces Moreland's family.
Yeah.
Gives them a real reason and motivation and a methodology was the other thing. The multi-dimensional methodology of it was just, to be able to take pastoral elements, even Ezekiel, you know, and all the controversial stuff at the time was the fact that JMS observed that Spider-Man and all his villains were totems.
Great.
And a gun. A lot of the fan press and a lot of the fans in the letters were angry about that at the time, but it was an interesting thing to explore, and again, I don't feel like JMS quite explored it to its full extent. He brought it up, and then he sort of peeled it back because of the complaints. And then here's Dan Slott just picking up all these balls and running with them in a cast of literally thousands of
as Dan Slott is wont to do with most of his things.
And again,
lots of balls in the air.
And again, I don't think it quite, Clone Conspiracy didn't quite gel for me.
No.
You know, it was a great attempt. I applaud him attempting it.
Yeah.
But it all, for me, it all sort of fell into place with Spider-Verse.
I think quite a lot of people are saying at this point Dan Slott's kind of burned out on Spider-Man. So I'd be happy to see him take Fantastic Four and do something with it. Although I am enjoying the most recent storyline.
Yes. Well,
the Red Goblin and all that. So.
Yeah, as a finale, it's been terrific so far.
I'm not quite as enamored as Spider-Verse. I preferred Superior Spider-Man. I thought that was a much better.
I thought so. I'll agree with you. And again, the reason why that it's an auto story, which sort of excluded it. It shouldn't, because...
Oh, it's not on my list, but I would just say if I were comparing it.
Yeah.
Because to me, it's like, what would someone who's smarter than Peter do with Spider-Man?
Yeah.
And Doc Ock definitely, he learns to be a hero.
Oh yeah,
but he also
because
is able
of Peter
to
as well. This is the other thing. Peter's influence is there, even though he's not there.
In the end, he sacrifices himself because he believes that only Peter Parker can save the situation. So
fantastic ending, and in some ways, you kind of wish Slott had left Otto there, and then let someone else bring him back.
Yeah, well, Clone Conspiracy was his way of setting things right.
That's true. Well, putting the toys back in the toy box as he was leaving.
I like that he takes these things that are perhaps upset people at one time, like, oh, the clones again. That thing that Straczynski did that upset everybody. And he goes there, and he messes with it and has fun and add something. Like, I'm not one of those people who get mad when the status quo of the character is messed with.
As long as it's interesting.
Yeah, like, interesting. Keep the character doing what he does.
An engaging read that keeps the core of the characters.
Yeah, that's all I want to see. So seeing, at first I was totally against the Superior Spider-Man concept of like, well, I want to read Peter Parker. Why is there no book on this show? Well, because I was getting back into going to the comic shop. So I was like, where's Amazing? They're like, oh no, it's Peter's dead. Dr. Octopus and Spider-Man. I'm like,
for me, at this point, Slott had earned his because he had done such a great run up to then. I'm like, I'm all in.
Yeah,
what I loved about Superior was every issue topped itself.
Oh yeah,
yes, it got better and better and better.
As Peter's trying to fight his way through the subconscious to get back to trial, racism.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
And he's dead. You know, how is Peter ever going to come back from this?
Yeah,
a little slice of consciousness is still there.
Yeah,
and beaten down and.
And you knew they'd find a way. And for me,
with all these things, it's...
I will agree that Superior is Slott's best Spider-Man story. Unfortunately, it's a Doc Ock story, so that's why I did Spider-Verse instead.
It is a Spider-Man story, but it takes 30 issues for Peter to push himself
eventually,
up from under the
rubble.
And he is at the lowest point you'll ever get.
Yeah,
it
makes you really dig Otto as well.
Yes.
And for so long, Otto's been kind of a joke. I remember reading those Ditko issues where Otto was a real menace, and he unmasked Spider-Man at one point in front of Jameson and Thing, and it was just dangerous.
Yep.
Yes.
And but then there's that arrogance. It's like, oh, it's this Peter Parker kid. He couldn't possibly be Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And then just dismisses it. And that's his defining moment early on, right? But and then he's been up and down too, right? Just because the whole Roy, oh, it's Roy Orbison with although Byrne did a great Doc Ock one shot where he was trying to get Doc as the expert in radiation to look at Sue, who would eventually have a difficult pregnancy.
She had a miscarriage, but although that was
retconned
later as the birth of Valeria. But so he goes to appeal. Doc Ock is crazy. He's in an asylum.
Mm-hmm.
So he appeals to him through his genius, his intellect, to come back and help him. And he's able to bring Otto back. Because Octavius is... Or Doc Ock is crazy. He's eventually becomes megalomaniacal and you know, fighting Spider-Man is doing him kind of batty over the years. And I think that was kind of the return that you would later see with Return of the Sinister Six.
Yes.
Like Doc Ock was off limits for a long time, and this was a way to bring him back.
And
as
they gave
smart.
Him the adamantium.
He upgraded his arms.
During that run as well, and then. And then Slott did such a great job throughout his run of making him dangerous again.
Yes.
And he had nothing to lose, and he had cancer, and what an engaging character. And was it Zeb Wells who did the Doc Ock origin miniseries? I thought that was quite well done.
Is that the Spider-Man Doc Ock one that...
goes back and looks at Doc's origin and childhood.
Year One, I think it was called. That was the Kari Andrews series.
Oh, was it Kari Andrews?
Yeah, he won a Schuster Award for that one.
Oh, did he? Okay. No. Now, did he draw it and write it as well, or was it...
Kari illustrated it.
Okay,
so it was,
I want to say Zeb Wells, but this is what the internet's for, right?
Yeah.
My, I remember reading, Superior Spider-Verse, and Superior Spider-Man was included in the story. So that moment where he goes back in time to where he's still Spider-Man before Peter's resurrected and he realizes that he's lost, that little nugget that you can go back into reading Superior and see that moment there, and then it's I love that. That was great. That he was thinking about these things. It's almost like that thing we were talking about before with Infinity War. It's like they showed you something and they didn't forget it.
Yeah.
Here's the payoff for it. So all those little things that he had, like you said, the juggling chainsaws, it was quite a feat for him to pull that off.
Oh, yeah.
If you feel he did,
and
I love it.
Kevin was right. Kar Andrews and Zeb Wells in that Doc Ock miniseries.
Okay, so our this or that before round two.
Alrighty.
Okay. Gwen or Mary Jane?
Mary Jane.
Gwen.
Okay. Doc Ock or the Goblin?
Goblin.
Goblin,
okay. Venom or Carnage?
Venom.
Yeah, Carnage sucks. Venom sucks.
Okay.
So the Joker gets like symbiote.
Although this new storyline I'm surprised it hasn't been done before. It seems to be a great... And it, just to jump back to the whole Goblin thing, Doc Ock, to me, is very iconic and has been given a lot of love lately. But can I say that whole arc that Norman had following Secret Invasion, I think it was Warren Ellis' Thunderbolts?
Yep.
Just before that.
Yep.
And then Bendis' Dark Avengers.
Yep.
And then
it started with Secret Invasion, where Osborn basically saves the day.
Mm-hmm.
He steps in with the Thunderbolts and saves everyone.
Yeah,
and
Warren Ellis was writing.
Destroyed.
Warren Ellis was writing Thunderbolts at the time, with a batshit crazy Norman Osborn trying to act normal with this Suicide Squad like team.
Mm-hmm. He was running Hammer, right? That's what he called it.
Just before Hammer, it was him running the Thunderbolts, and as a result of him, did he shoot the head off of the Skrull Queen?
Yeah.
Is that the...
Yeah, he murders the Skrull Queen, and they all give up at that point. And he saves humanity. and since there was no shield, he's given control, and they take it away from Tony Stark in that.
Yeah.
Because Tony was head of shield post-Civil War.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then after that, he starts replacing the Avengers.
Yeah.
And making his own Avengers.
Yeah, and just running around batshit crazy, being the big bad.
Yeah.
Of the Marvel universe, while acting as the cop, you know, the
meeting with the heroes, then you walk down the hall, open a door, and there's Doctor Doom,
the Cabal,
and
the Cabal, and the anti Illuminati, as we put them. I always thought that was a great way to reinvigorate Osborn.
And I think, you know, in the movies going down the line, I think if they introduce Osborn,
oh yeah,
I think they would head towards that secret invasion.
Oh, that would be phenomenal.
Storyline with Osborn. I think that would be phase two, because they've tended to follow the Ultimates in a lot of ways.
That's true. Yeah. And to me, the Ultimates, they didn't get the Goblin quite right in the Ultimate Universe.
No.
The Hulk, like, I like the super soldier angle, but again, he should have been more of a super soldier than a Hulk.
Yeah.
Which seemed all wrong and not iconic.
No.
Yeah. No.
Which is what they were hoping for.
Yeah.
And all the merchandise where the Ultimate Goblin does show up.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the 616 Goblin was phenomenal during that period as well.
Well, very interesting that they brought him back in Revelation. They'd written themselves into a corner with the Clone Saga, and they had no idea they had to get out. So the only way they could really do it was to bring back a big bad who was dead. And there were certain characters that were off limits. You didn't bring Gwen back, and you didn't bring Norman Osborn back because of 121 and 122 being so powerful. Everybody's favorite Spider-Man stories. To bring Norman Osborn back kind of undoes that story in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that the Revelations trade, the last, I think it's Spider-Man 75, and Romita Jr. comes back to pencil it, and it's basically the night of the Goblin. The Green Goblin reveals that he's been the person behind all of this stuff happening with the Clone Saga, and he kills Ben Reilly and all that stuff. That was a powerful issue to me. It's not one of my top 10, but it was.
Yeah, I've heard that. Howard Mackey has said that that's the one that he gets a lot of people saying to him they really appreciate.
And again, the clone, it meandered, it got confusing, but they did get the ending quite right, but the end result of Osborn, like them in closed doors meetings saying, okay, it's Osborn.
They made a fatal error by choosing the clone over Spider-Man. So I'd like to say that the Peter that we've been reading about since 1963 was a clone, and that the real Spider-Man was wandering around America with blonde hair and was unmarried and didn't know. That to me was a huge misstep, because it took away that, it said basically, oh yeah, all that soap opera you've been following, irrelevant.
Everything you like.
Yeah.
This is them trying again and again to come up with the solution for the married Spider-Man. Like, I having reread and looked back, they were absolutely right. The soap opera was really important to Spider-Man, and has really in Brand New Day, etc. And even looking at Ultimate Spider-Man, the soap opera really, really was an element that was missing.
Yeah.
That could have, but then they mishandled the marriage in so many ways too.
I enjoyed the marriage when they made it work. Like, JMS when he
Spider-Man
had them back
Blue.
Together. Yeah.
That should be the way the marriage is handled.
Yeah. But to always have to try to reset it, or just it was ruining what could have been.
Or putting that element of soap opera. I think for a while there they wanted to Mary Jane wouldn't actually have an affair with her soap opera co-star. But they brought her to the edge, which made her completely unlikable again. It's difficult writing.
Well, she was pregnant, and what are they going to do? Is Spider-Man going to be a father? Are they going to allow that to happen?
Yeah.
And then, reading the book at the time, I still think the kid's alive somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
That they,
I do, too.
They save the baby. And so that's if I were writing Spider-Man, I would totally bring that back. I would say, let's follow that thread.
It's
and
a slow burn.
Osborn was involved in some ways.
Yeah.
So maybe if I were Dan Slott and I were going out with Spider-Man 800, maybe that's something I'd bring back. Because he seems to be bringing Mary Jane back in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I don't think he wants Mary Jane as part of his Iron Man cast. So Mary Jane will go back to being a Spider-Man cast member.
I have enjoyed Mary Jane as the in a different context.
Yes.
Moving her over, letting her be. I think it was great letting her be her own character.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the way she's handled, she might as well have been Pepper.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the you know, as opposed to how Mary Jane would handle something.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, wasn't it nice to see her back for this last storyline? And
yeah.
again, that tease, that soap opera, will they or won't they? Which
yeah.
is again the best parts of the earliest Mary Jane and Peter stuff leading up to the marriage.
Yeah. Shall we continue?
Yes.
Round
sure.
our number twos in the interest of time.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, my number two is Amazing Spider-Man 248, the backup story, the kid who collects Spider-Man.
Oh,
you know?
Of course.
I think that's probably the best Spider-Man story of all time.
I think my number one gives it context, but number two, basically, it's like the ultimate fan story.
Yeah.
We're the kids that collect Spider-Man.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so here's a kid in the Spider-Man universe that collects Spider-Man-related things. And since, you know, without comics, what's it like in the Marvel Universe if you're a Spider-Man fan? Well, you dig bullets out of walls, and you take pictures, and you clip them to the Daily Bugle,
yeah.
and all that stuff. And then to find that the kid is dying of cancer, and he asks him, like, flat out, you know, who are you? And Peter reveals his identity, and that's such a huge step because that's his closely guarded.
Mm-hmm.
Why would he share this with his kid? Who just collects Spider-Man memorabilia, and you know he's seems like a great kid, and then
yeah.
then they showed the actually it ends with the newspaper article where we find out that he's dying of cancer. But to me it was and Ron Frenz came in and did it in that Ditko style.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right.
To be reminiscent of those early years and what was going on. Very dramatic, and the lighting at one point when he takes his mask off. He lights Peter in the same way that you see in the final frame of Amazing Fantasy 15, when he's looking and he's seen at the he's holding the burglar, and he's lit up from below, so you see his chin up, and his reaction is kind of the same when he takes off his mask and says, holds it in his hands, "I'm Peter Parker, and I was the guy that took all those pictures and all that stuff." So just a magical story, very
yes. yeah.
really good. Roger Stern to me was one of the best Spider-Man writers.
Yeah, I agree.
And to me, that's the icing on the cake of his run.
I agree.
Yeah. And the front half of the issue is very good too.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to put that on my list because I again, that was that story. Even though it's a backup story, it's in that category of the ones you guys were mentioning before: Kraven's Last Hunt, Death of Gwen Stacy. But you have to read this.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is a phenomenon. And there's no... What did you call it last time we were talking? Kick bam? Kick pow?
Oh, kick explode. Yeah.
Kick explode.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't get that action, but it's
no.
all heart.
Yes. Agreed.
No. Yeah. It's a fantastic issue.
There was another
especially
story
as a backup.
Yeah. That I considered, which is in the same vein as I Remember Gwen.
Yeah.
From Amazing Spider-Man 365.
Yes.
When it's Mary Jane remembering what Gwen
yes.
Stacy was like.
The black cover with the hologram.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a great story.
That lump in the throat kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
For,
very
for sure.
good.
Now, I seem to remember at the time when I read that, I thought Superman did a similar thing, I want to say, but Spider-Man did it better. Was
yeah.
it
yeah.
Pete Ross's kid who...
Oh, might have been.
Superman had to reveal his identity because for some reason... To Pete Ross's kid, very similar, but then it again had a lot more, and it might have been an earlier story from an earlier era, but I felt the Spider-Man one had
mm-hmm.
more of a punch as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
Oh, and the flip side of that would also be the goofier version is Spider-Kid.
Oh.
The kid with the Doc Ock arm? He was originally
right.
a Doc Ock
right.
fan, and then he became Spider-Kid, and then actually I think he showed up in Thunderbolts as well as
yeah.
like the Silver Spider or something, then
yeah.
caused Norman to go off the deep end because of the
yeah.
Spider-Man connection, which is hilarious. But
yeah.
Ollie Osnick.
Yes.
Ollie Osnick, the Spider Kid.
You say your memory is not that good. I think it's pretty good.
Well,
there's that great issue of Peter Parker where at Hannigan cover he's trapped in a like giant fishbowl basically with Ollie, and Ollie has his Doc Ock arms. At that point, he was worshiping Dr. Octopus.
Yeah, yeah. And then would show up a few more times as Spider-Kid. Like,
yeah.
And then eventually joined with, was it Leapfrog and the Toad to be like a misfit team of...
Yeah.
which again, not our favorite, but goofy fun.
Yeah. Okay, so this is going to be my number one pick because I had Spider-Man Blue. So I just read it on the train coming here to remind myself about it. It was a Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man written by Paul Jenkins and Humberto Ramos, Death in the Family. I don't know if you guys have ever... You remember that one? Yep. It's a Norman and Peter story.
Yep.
It's a short one, but it's very, very poignant. And it's basically, I would say, Spider-Man's Killing Joke, where Norman is trying to push him to the limit of insanity to do something he would never do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in the process, Norman, again, has all the pieces in play to take out all of Peter's family because he knows who they are. He's even threatening to kill his grandson.
Doesn't he want Peter to be his son?
Yeah.
Because he visits Harry's grave.
Mm-hmm.
And... I think
Harry was a fool, basically. Yeah. He wanted Peter is the obvious heir.
Yes.
Over the grandson, even.
Right.
And
Flash Thompson is in a coma.
Oh, that's right. He puts him in a coma, and then he's a vegetable for the rest of that Peter Parker run.
That's right.
As well, but yeah, it was a real sort of Darth Vader and Luke.
Yes,
moment.
Very much.
Join me or else.
Yes.
And then Flash goes into a wall.
Yes, exactly.
And Humberto Ramos, he'd go on to do some great stuff.
Yeah.
The redesign of the Green Goblin costume
is very good.
Especially during a time when Ultimate Goblin was running around with all the merchandise.
Yes.
I remember when Toy Biz came out with that figure. I had to have that figure.
Yeah, no, it's a great design. And I'm not a huge Humberto Ramos fan at this point. It grew on me. But the ending of it where... They have that moment where he says, you know, you're never going to defeat me. And you being Norman Osborn is more of a punishment than I could ever give you.
Mm-hmm.
And he sends him the slice of, or the pizza pie with the $5 bill on top. Because Norman made him a bet. He goes, I bet you a five and a pizza that I can make you do it. And Peter sends it to him at the end. And Norman opens up the drawer and looks at the gun to possibly kill himself because he knows he'll never best him. And for a short story, it's four issues, not in Amazing Spider-Man. It's probably somewhat forgotten, but it's kind of one of those ones that if you can find it, read it. It's worthwhile. Very powerful.
There's a lot of great ones in that run. I think the Lizard storyline in that... run was also redefining. Like, I think, but Jenkins initially just had a lot of goofy villains in his Peter Parker Spider-Man, but when he switched over, I guess he had such success, was it the Chameleon, that he got to sort of play with a little bit?
Yes.
And then following the...
Day in the Life.
Yeah, following the Chameleon, and he on that Spectacular series, I think he tackled Venom, the Lizard, Green Goblin...
Yeah, no, it's
quite
a great
a few
run.
Iconic. It's Doc Ock. There was a Doc Ock storyline.
No problem.
All right, let us continue. We've relocated outside of the restaurant, and now it is time for Sam's number two pick.
We've closed
out the restaurant. He said, "Come on, guys, stop talking about comics."
Interesting that you should follow up on that. We've talked about the Paul Jenkins run. And there's some really great stuff. And again, it's not the most even run. There's some real up and down, but there's some real gems in there. And I really quite enjoyed the Green Goblin run. For me, though, I was what sort of trumps that one. I've chose Marvel Knights Spider-Man, the Mark Miller, Terry and Rachel Dodson run with a couple of issues done by Frank Cho. And I really think because this was the follow-up to the storyline you were talking about. I'm not quite sure of the timeline, but I'm fairly sure this was the first major Norman Osborn Green Goblin storyline to follow that. He's certainly wearing that revamped outfit, and there's even, in terms of that whole... join me in my evil empire thing. One of the very first lines when Peter is
beating up the goblin right at the beginning was, "Who's your daddy, Norman? Who's your daddy?" Which to me was hilarious in light of the Jenkins storyline. I chose this because to me this is sort of the pinnacle of what we call the Spider-Man popcorn comics. The kicks flow, the action, the little bit of the emotional stuff. Probably for me, the most consistent 12-issue run of Spider-Man I can think of in terms of one cohesive epic story. The artwork is firing on all cylinders. It's just gorgeous to look at. Really snappy dialogue, who's who of his villains coming in and out, and essentially a quest. Someone mysterious kidnaps Aunt May, and Peter basically spends 12 issues. And again, this is the Aunt May that knows Peter Parker's Spider-Man.
Right.
And they do a little bit of the early exploration of the, you know, there's some snappy dialogue between him and Aunt May. And at the end, again, spoilers, it turns out Norman was... well, it was a straw dog as well, because he just beats him up and throws him in jail at the beginning and then sort of visits him a couple of times throughout. But it's almost like... what's the Liam Neeson series where his daughter is...
Taken.
Yeah, Taken. Straight up Taken. It sort of follows that storyline, and that his quest through the whole thing is to tear his way through the underworld of New York at that time.
That was a fun series. I remember reading that.
Yeah. Fun. Kingpin's in jail. There's a power vacuum. There's some weird day in the life stuff of Electro and Vulture, like visiting a brothel or something like that. So I think equal parts action, adventure, comedy. I think the ingredients were just perfect for pop comics, as I like to call it.
Yeah, and Mark Miller's the right guy to do a story like that.
Yeah, especially following up on that exploration of the Norman Peter relationship. He just sort of took that and then had fun with it.
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, nice pick. Did you enjoy that series?
I did. I like that series quite a lot. It covers a lot of bases. Obviously, you get to see most of the main Spider-Man cast. Some big ramifications for Venom in that story.
Oh, yeah. Mark Gagnon, the Scorpion, becomes the Venom.
Gargan,
sorry. Yes. Did I say gargle?
You said Gagnon.
Gargamel?
He's like French.
Like it's French-Canadian. But yeah, there's a lot in that. I mean, the fact that Eddie Brock has decided he's found religion and he wants to get rid of the symbiote.
Mm-hmm. And again, that was following up on Paul Jenkins and Humberto Ramos' storyline as well. I think it was the first arc of that relaunch of Spectacular Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Now, that storyline in Marvel Knights stay in continuity? Because I think there were some things that were established in there that were never revisited. Something about the fact that all of the villains were appointed certain heroes that they would always have to... It was like a cabal or something.
Oh, yeah, that's
like
right.
Secret Society.
I feel like it kind of fed into the Thunderbolts and the Hammer run somewhat.
It's very very Mark Miller.
Yeah,
conspiracy theory stuff.
Yeah,
for sure. And this is the way... the other thing is, I felt like this is the way the Mary Jane marriage should be handled. Like, there was some real snappy dialogue about, like, they keep revisiting this, but then Peter accepts that, she can run away and hide, but then she's got to come and face this and be a part of this search and this conflict and the support system that he has.
Yeah.
Also, a great little scene of the relationship between Black Cat and Mary Jane as well, in contrast with the early days when they were sort of rivals for each other.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, good series. Good pick.
No, great series, it reminds me of the worst series, Trouble.
That's right.
Trouble.
Again, the same
Mark
creative
Miller's
team.
Other, yeah, he spun out of that, and there was, what was that guy's name? The guy that was head of Marvel at the time.
Jemis. They were trying to have a book that they could market to the teen girl YA audience.
Yeah.
And what was it? a young May, a young Ben, and then a young Mary set Richard, of Peter Parker's parents. And wasn't the revelation that Aunt May was actually his biological mother?
Yes, the revelation of that story is that May gives birth to the child that would be Peter.
Yeah, and then Mary and
Ben
adopts him.
Ben was the... Ben wasn't the father. Richard was the father.
Yeah, it was yeah. May
weird.
Having
that's
an affair
not, that's
one
horrible.
Summer.
It was a terrible story that they
it
just...
It was a summer fling.
They had the horrible. Same names, but they never equated it to... Like, you could read behind the lines
yeah.
and say, oh, that's supposed to be Spider-Man, but...
It was like when they tried to make the whole Goblin and Gwen thing in the gym.
Oh, yeah. That was... Yeah, that's right up there, too.
Osborn...
Gwen had an affair
ruined,
with...
Yeah, you can't...
And then had two I rapidly growing...
Yeah. That's...
One who looked like Norman and the other looked like Gwen. Like
yeah.
Gwen. Horrible.
But Mark Miller often does come in and try to upset the cart a little bit, and I think
sure.
in terms of the conspiracy, for me it kind
yeah.
of worked, like looking at it that way.
Yeah.
But again, and I think some of the other people picked up elements of that and then ran with it. With
even if it was true, it's a story that we didn't need.
Fair
right?
enough.
It's
fair
one
enough.
That what was the point of this?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the real point of it was to show two teenage girls in various...
Oh, I'm sorry, you meant Trouble.
Trouble, yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
The JMS story with the Goblin and...
Yeah, we don't need that.
Yeah.
No.
It was trying to tie something back and revive... Again, going back to the beginning, going back to the high points and reviving something from that.
But you don't want to make it... I don't know, you don't want to crap on the grave of
yeah.
the memory of what
yeah.
what made Gwen,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. You can, I think largely that's gone ignored. You know, even Slott, who you know, there's no sacred cows that I won't touch, has refused to touch that one, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right. Although he did bring Gwen back in.
Cold
oh, that's true. That's
yeah.
true. But then no sign,
no mention
of the
yeah,
the
no.
daughter and the son. And wasn't there some weird incestuous stuff as well between
the brother
the,
and the sister, maybe,
or Peter and the grown up Gwen. Clone almost like there. I think there was some.
Well,
a
they were related,
Easter.
So it wouldn't be.
That's true.
Yeah,
although I guess
creepy.
In terms of creepy, and that this is the daughter of
yeah.
his.
But they also tried to introduce more Stacys into the mix. If you
oh,
recall,
right,
they
the
brought
cousin.
Back the brother of Captain Stacy,
George Stacy, and
yeah.
and Gwen's cousin, right?
Yeah.
Was she ever a love interest? I can't even remember. She was just a
she
supportive
was
friend.
Lurking around as a potential love interest, but they never went that far.
Yeah.
That was during Mackie's run, right?
Yeah.
Okay. George Stacy is Gwen's dad, right?
Yeah.
Was it so?
Oh, okay.
Was
who was
Jill's
the brother?
And
so the brother was, I don't know, his I don't
also
know.
A police
Paul?
Officer named
Paul Stacy?
Maybe.
Something like
I
that.
I don't remember. It's I guess we forgot it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess they just... Looping back to Marvel Knights Spider-Man, that conspiracy bit that you mentioned, I feel like does sort of feed into Thunderbolt, Hammer, the Cabal, somewhat I feel like, in terms of Norman being a bigger, you know, guy who pulls the strings. I think this was the first inkling of that, and then others sort of ran with the ball. First Ellis, then Bendis, and then back to Slott.
Yeah. Interesting but sad fact was that Marvel Knights Spider-Man was the last trade that Deborah read before she passed away, my late girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you got to read this Spider-Man. It's got everything in it. It was one of those stories where you could refer to someone else and say, here's...
It's true. It's like that.
All the classic villains.
Yeah.
Here's the relationship of Peter and Mary Jane that they should have.
Is it kind of? Would you say it's kind of like Spider-Man's equivalent of a Hush, a 12
issue
series?
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, sort of the pop,
yeah,
pop
that,
kick-splode, you
that,
know,
yeah.
a little bit of everything.
Good
and,
starting
and,
point to get the whole gamut
yeah,
of what this
yeah.
character's
it's got
world
twist
is.
Ending. You know,
yeah.
it's got that twist ending, but it all makes sense within the context of itself. And it should have ended at 12, but they continued it, didn't they?
The series itself continued for quite a while. It became the fourth Spider-Man title. Like, and there was bits about Wolverine and Mary Jane being in the Avengers Tower together.
Oh, that's right. That's
potential
right.
for a side romance because Wolverine likes redheads.
Things like that. I felt like the rest of that run didn't quite live up to the initial
pretty forgettable
12 12 issues.
Yeah.
Cool. And then, did you have your side questions before we get to the last?
I gotta go into my book. So my first side question in this round was going to be Clone Saga or Brand New Day or One More Day. Which one was worse or better?
Sorry, One More Day or Clone Saga?
Yeah, One More Day or the Clone Saga.
So the JMS Quesada story or the Clone Saga? I would probably go with One More Day being better than the Clone Saga because it didn't last.
It's just as quick.
Yeah.
It was over
in
a month.
It was like a Band-Aid.
Yeah, right off.
I understand why they did One More Day, but for me it just didn't work, especially for Straczynski to stick the landing of his run. You know, it went off the rails long before that. We talked about the Goblin stuff and the Goblin and Stacy, Gwen Stacy romance, but just given the craziness and the scope of the clone thing and the fact that it is, there's an element of absurd comedy to what happened and how big and crazy it got. There's obviously a fondness we have.
Yeah, there's a nostalgia factor to it.
About talking about the Clone Saga or all the nuttiness that happened around it. Even though we don't like it, it's a part of history we like to kind of point at every now and then.
I remember at the time being intrigued because it brought back the Jackal.
Yes.
It brought back other characters that we hadn't seen for many years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stakes were high.
Yeah.
There's elements you liked. You know, we said we liked the fact that it brought back Norman.
Eventually.
Yeah.
But that was
a fix-up.
Yeah, but then just all the pointless cross thread, like the cape.
What was Ben Reilly on the road stories? And then we had the... Since Peter was no longer the real Spider-Man, now we had to have the...
Ben Reilly epics.
Yeah.
And then that...
We had to have that series with Peter and Mary Jane off in the middle of nowhere.
That's right. And then Spider-Man The Lost Years, was it?
That was actually pretty good.
And that was Romita Jr. on that.
Yeah, there was a lot of patches, like continuity patches.
Yes.
And then
you had to read
like,
every title.
What was his name? The Judas Traveler or something like that? Like, again, another pointless cane circling.
That's a loaded question. We could go on.
Too many
just
cooks in the kitchen.
That.
But
yeah.
It went on for years. And he had to go to jail. And he had to go
That's right.
they couldn't dig themselves out of it, so they were just digging that hole deeper and deeper. In the end, I think I would take One More Day any day of the week.
It's just a quick...
Yeah.
One and done. Okay, let us finally get to our number ones, the ones we've all been waiting to discuss with each other, the ones we saved to the last. Kev?
All right, well, I mean, I went... The easiest choice you could make. I went right to the start, and I went with AF-15. And in some ways, I think Spider-Man 1 is a continuation of that story.
Yeah.
So, and both stories were entitled Spider-Man with an exclamation mark. So, to me, they're kind of like one story in a sense that we get the origin of Spider-Man, which is a fantastic story. I mean, the fact that, first off, he's a teenager. Two, he doesn't become a superhero right off the bat. He decides to use his powers for money and glory first. And then he learns a life lesson, and probably the most powerful life lesson in comics. With great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
Cements Lee and Ditko as the Spider-Man team, in my mind, with that story. And then you follow it up in Spider-Man 1 by presenting the people who stood against him. So the media were not, because he was a celebrity and then he became a hero, the media didn't believe him. And in fact, in some ways, it's like now.
Right.
You know, like if a YouTube star suddenly did something heroic, you'd be like, it's just doing it for fame. He's doing it for more glory. He wants money. So that whole thing with J. Jonah Jameson. And then, of course, to save Jameson's son in that storyline, too, gives that his villain is also, owes him in a sense, right, for saving his son, the astronaut. And then you get a little bit of interaction with the Marvel Universe, which we haven't had up until that point, really. We've had I don't think the Avengers have even shown up yet at this time. So to have Spider-Man and show up at the FF's headquarters and say, I want a job. And then
how
saying,
much does it pay?
Yeah. I thought that was amazing. That was starting to cement what the Marvel Universe could be. Which the powerful moments that we've seen in different ways in the cinematic universe as the characters start to interact with one another. Like in Avengers 1.
And they were crossing over in a way that the DC characters weren't. You know what I mean? It's this friendly, amicable, you know, sitting across the table from each other.
Basically, it was like Joe meets Bob. Hey, Bob, how are you doing, Joe? You know, like, that's the DC superheroes. Like, well, Clark, yes, Bruce. You know,
they really felt like New Yorkers. I always felt like the Marvel crossovers, they were just your typical New Yorkers, kind of in each other's faces.
And they didn't like each other. You could tell they just couldn't put up with each other. Like, Johnny Storm saw another kid. Ben Grimm saw, like, some kind of grandstander. You know, like, all these different things.
Mm-hmm. Reed saw someone who was had his priorities misplaced.
Yeah. And then in a creepy way, Sue was attracted to him.
She always is. Yeah. Between Namor and...
What a powerful stranger. But to me, all of these other stories don't have context without the story of Peter getting his powers, what happens to his Uncle Ben, his relationship with Aunt May, and then his relationship with J. Jonah Jameson. Because all of those things set all the tone. That's still going on today. So even in Spectacular, where Jonah now knows that Peter is Spider-Man, that colors his whole perspective. You get to see that whole revisiting of you know, 30 years or 40 or whatever it is, 50 years of Spider-Man comics from a different perspective.
The three-dimensional, four-dimensional storytelling we're talking, all that resonance concentrated into that one moment where he pulls off his mask in Peter Parker 6. Was it Peter Parker 6, Chip Zdarsky, and Michael Walsh?
Yeah,
big issue.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to see where that goes. Had a pretty fun follow-up with Jonah helping Spider-Man in that escape the building.
That was a fun story, and now they're in the past.
Yeah,
and that's been interesting too. So, but I have to say, something happened there with that title because it wasn't. I don't think it started off very well. But I think as soon as they did the J. Jonah Jameson story where he interviews Peter and then he reveals that he's Spider-Man, I think that, to me, that was a game changer. And the book has been interesting since.
Well, the fact
before that was just goofy Chip Zdarsky comedy stuff.
It was very precious. But then, that whole My Dinner with Andre thing. Yeah. How gripping was it for us as readers to just have these two sitting across from each other with all their history and going over the ground and knowing actually that they were family, I think was the other...
But now after all the convoluted history, you know, Peter Parker and J. Jonah Jameson are brothers, right?
That's great.
So, yeah.
Brother cousins.
Something like that, yeah.
All right, Sam. AF-15.
Oh, because you picked...
Spider-Man you picked Blues. This is, it's Spider-Man all comes down Blue. To you.
You know what? I kind of picked... to me, again, this is revisiting the origin... I picked Peter Parker, Spider-Man 20. Paul Jenkins, Mark Buckingham. Again, I think there's some real gems in that run. But essentially, it revisits the origin of Spider-Man in that we see where he gets his sense of humor from. I don't think we had previously...
I just read this.
Yeah, we had previously seen. So he arrives... at what an old person's house. He's dumped off by his parents. He's a tiny little kid, and we learn that Uncle Ben is the source of Spider-Man's sense of humor.
Yeah, but don't you get that in the first story right away too, though?
A little.
You get a bit
little.
Of that, where Aunt May's very serious, but Uncle Ben's the guy that comes and tussles his hair and says...
That's true, true.
Don't let studying be your only thing. You got to have fun with life.
That's true. I just love the fact they expanded on it. It was a really heartwarming story, because the context, again, the context of this was Mary Jane had just, quote-unquote, died, and he was trying to cope with
plane crash one?
Yeah, her apparent death, and everyone was telling he was dead, but he didn't necessarily believe it or was sure whether he should believe it. But it gave context, because I guess he was mourning the loss of his parents, like Peter as a young kid. And it was just a fun you know, amidst tragedy, there were some laugh out loud moments too in terms of the practical jokes they played with each other. And then I also kind of look at this in the context of the other little one-shot stories that Buckingham and Jenkins did. There was also, and again, we're like right...
The negative one and
all well, let's roll right into my honorable mentions then, because again, it was really hard for me to choose the Buckingham and Jenkins one that... because there's also... where is it? Oh, yeah, Peter Parker, Spider-Man 33. Why Peter Parker is a Mets fan. And so every year, this is the story where every year Peter Parker, on the anniversary of Uncle Ben's death, unlike Aunt May, who goes to visit his grave, he goes to see a Mets game. And you flash back to young Peter Parker going with his uncle and experiencing that sort of near victory, you know, what was it? Victory snatched from the hands of defeat? Is that the proper, when the Mets lose after nearly winning? And yeah, just sort of cements Peter's underdog status. In there as well, I also had Spectacular Spider-Man 27, the last Paul Jenkins issue, where it's kind of a homage to Calvin and Hobbes, where he's capping off his... Jenkins is capping off his time on Spider-Man, and they homage Calvin making the weird snowman sculptures and getting a rise from Aunt May, essentially in that sort of bittersweet fashion. It, again, I see it as sort of part and parcel of that. And then other honorable mention. Peter Parker, Spider-Man 35. You and I, Eric, talked about this last time. Spider-Man is the imaginary friend of a small African-American boy with a troubled life who finally... And again, I think this is evocative of the story, the boy who collected Spider-Man as well.
Yeah,
it, it was in that same vein where you know, to him, he found comfort in Spider-Man in a story where Spider-Man doesn't actually show up at all. It sort of takes place in this kid's imagination. Yeah, as I barrel through that little batch,
I had a ton of honorable mentions, but I'll do the what I had as 6 to 10.
Okay.
So Spider-Man Annual 1, the first appearance of the Sinister Six.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Doc Ock gathers Electro, Sandman, Mysterio, Kraven, and that was a fun story. And set, they've been repeating that nonstop pretty much since. Spider-Man 39 and 40, How Green Was My Goblin, Spidey Saves the Day. Basically, Norman Osborn learns that Peter Parker is Spider-Man.
My favorite Spider-Man cover.
Yeah, well, the way he's flying him through the air, But what a big... I mean, here we are, the 39th issue... And his archenemy, and it cements Blue Goblin as the archenemy, of course, has learned his secret identity and could destroy his entire life. And we're seeing that again now, and we're talking about Peter, the Spectacular run. In the past, we're seeing Norman Osborn is destroying everything. He's a dangerous man. He's not someone to be taken for granted. And I think that cemented it, although... I think in the 60s, the selective amnesia was getting a little bit overused. So the Goblin had to be brought out for only the really special stories, like the Comics Code story where Harry Osborn was on drugs and the Green Goblin came back. So I had a lot of classic stuff on here. I had the Spider-Man No More storyline, Spider-Man Annual 2, Wondrous World of Doctor Strange, which sort of compared how... the worlds of Ditko could collide with Doctor Strange and Spider-Man. Spider-Man 100 to 102 with Morbius, and Spider-Man has six arms, which is kind of different. So the Spider, the man. I had a bunch of other ones. Like more recent ones were like the original Hobgoblin saga from Spider-Man 238 to 251.
You really wish they could have stuck that landing, eh? If Stern hadn't left?
Yeah, that was great.
Well, Roger Stern is my second favorite Spider-Man writer after after Lee. There were two annuals that came out in the 80s that were drawn by Frank Miller, Spider-Man Annual 14 and Spider-Man Annual 15. So 14 is a sort of a sequel to The Wondrous World of Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
With Doctor Strange and the Wand of Watoom and all that stuff again. And then the follow-up in 15, Spider-Man Threat or Menace, where essentially the Punisher is out of wreaking havoc, so Spider-Man has to stop the Punisher. In a sense, it's a sequel. I think Spider-Man arrests or captures the Punisher, and then the next time Punisher shows up, he's in Daredevil. In the famous run when he's in the prison and you see him escape.
One of the covers, is it like an orange cover with the, and then the other is the Target? Is that the one we're talking about?
So
the pink cover where they're standing in the Target?
In 181, the Death of Elektra issue, there's a scene where it's the Punisher is in prison, and I think that he escapes and Bullseye gets out at the same time too.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the Punisher shows up in 183 and 184. The one, you know, where the Daredevil's pointing the gun in one issue.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And then the blue cover where Punisher's sort of shooting Daredevil in the belly.
So that was sort of the lead up to that. But Frank Miller early, and I enjoyed his Spider-Man stuff. He did two issues of Spectacular as well, that 26 and 27.
Well, Spider-Man goes blind, right? And he needs Daredevil's help. Yeah, that led into the Daredevil series. I remember reading that in the collection, the Daredevil collection. Yeah, it's good stuff.
I had Coming Home as well, and Revelations, the following five issues, which included the 9/11 issue, and then the conversations with Aunt May about her discovery, and even the little moments where Aunt May is on the internet and sees people complaining about Spider-Man, and then she starts defending him.
Yeah,
she gets worked up in there. An important book for me. Remember how I said? I think I said earlier I stopped buying Spider-Man around 263. So, around that same time, X-Men 190 and 191 had just come out, which were a sequel to an issue of Marvel team-up with Spider-Man and Red Sonja, where Red Sonja discovers a necklace, or someone in the...
Mary Jane puts on a necklace.
Yeah, she picks up Red Sonja's sword and becomes Red Sonja. But another guy finds a necklace in this collection, and it has the spirit of this ancient
Kulan
sorcerer.
Kulan Gath.
Yes. And so Kulan Gath escapes... Spider-Man defeats him, and then years later, someone finds the necklace in thrown, like, because I guess at the end of the Marvel team-up issue, he tosses the necklace into the river.
The X-Men issues?
Yeah, so in 190, someone finds the necklace in the river, puts it on, and the entire island of Manhattan is changed. And so the Avengers, the X-Men, they're all like Conan-era kind of characters.
Yeah, it's like a Hyboria kind of Manhattan.
Except for Spider-Man. Who's speaking English and remembers everything, and he's still wearing his costume.
But he's, and tortured.
He's like enemy number one of this Hyborian state. And so I thought it was a great Spider-Man story, but at the end of the story, he's crucified.
Whoa.
And he's dying on the cross, and he makes as Spider-Man does, he does the master planner lifting whatever, and he snaps the cross. He does this heroic effort, snaps the cross, falls to the ground, and dies.
Aww.
Yeah. But his sacrifice is enough to inspire the heroes to remember that they're more than, you know, swordsmen and whatever else, and they end up defeating Kulan Gath. So to me, that's an important Spider-Man story, because in a sense I said, okay, Spider-Man died, I don't need to buy this.
But then you kept going for up until 400 after that.
Yeah.
I did love the Byrne Claremont
team-up run.
I first came across that, I think, well, in the original issues, but then caught up again on the ones that I missed when Marvel Tales.
First page of original art I got was from a Byrne issue with the Hulk.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Wood God. There's a character, forgettable.
Yeah.
There was a one-shot called Legacy of Evil, written by Kurt Busiek and drawn by Mark Teixeira, and it hasn't been made available on digital yet. But essentially it's something triggers a master plan of Norman Osborn, and these goblinette robots go to capture Normie Osborn and indoctrinate him into the Osborn legacy.
Oh, the Osborn cult.
Yeah. But this was not a cult. This was just robots. And so Spider-Man faces off against the computer with the personality of Norman Osborn. before we knew that he was alive and all that. But I mentioned Spider-Man 75, Night of the Goblin, the first new Avengers story arc where Spider-Man decides that maybe he could be an Avenger. And then I think one more, actually two more. Marvel Team Up 82 to 85 is a great story arc. Spider-Man finds Black Widow on a rooftop, but she doesn't remember that she's Black Widow. She thinks that she's someone else, and he's like, "No, you're Black Widow." She goes, "No, no, I'm not. I'm Natalia, whatever." And he goes, "No, I'm no Black Widow. Look under your clothes. You're wearing Black Widow's costume." And she's like, "No, I don't remember any of this." So the whole thing is she Black Widow or is she not? And along the way, there's a little bit of a romance that begins and stuff. So it turns out she was under deep cover by Nick Fury and been brainwashed into remembering something different. So that was a fun one. And then Spider-Man Annual 16 is a favorite of mine as well, with the debut of Monica Rambeau as the second Captain Marvel.
That's right.
Just really beautiful Romita Jr. artwork, embellished. I think he's inked by his father on the cover at least.
Yes.
But just look classic looking Spider-Man. That to me, that was the height of that run, was that sort of that around issue 250. Really nice, clean art. The sense of Spider-Man being weightless and bouncing around and being acrobatic. You don't get that till McFarlane, but McFarlane is all crazy contortions. And you don't get that sense of weight and airlessness. So sort of a, you know, even though he's jumping around and doing all these things, there's still gravity to it. And anyway, the fun parts of Spider-Man. I'm sure I could go on with more.
We could go on all night.
I'll quickly go down my honorable mentions list as the rest of my honorable mentions list. Obviously, Amazing 33 was in there. What else? We also mentioned Spectacular Spider-Man, the DiMatteo Salvacemi Harry Goblin versus Peter saga. I also put 9/11. JMS's Amazing issue as something that really kind of, for the time, really gave voice to what a lot of us were feeling. Although I do remember at the time as well, there's the counter argument that putting costume heroes in amongst, you know, the firefighters kind of was a little gaudy.
Yeah, but I don't think the comic fans at the time really reacted that way. I think they felt it was an appropriate response, like, where did the superheroes fit in this world?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that issue in particular really, even more than the DC one-shots, which I don't think hit very well.
They weren't related. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of relevance.
It was basically Superman and firefighters in pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there was no story. Yeah. This was basically, no, I mean, Joe Quesada saying, no, I mean, this Spider-Man would be there.
Yeah.
He would be at Ground Zero helping, and so would other characters.
And what were you feeling? And also, Straczynski really poured his heart into this, in all the interviews you read. But again, I do remember some of the controversies, so I was of kind of two minds of it, but I can't deny the impact it had on me. It would be interesting to reread it. I didn't actually go back and reread it, but what else do I have? We mentioned Peter Parker, Spider-Man number 6, the Jonah Peter dinner. A lot of great stuff in Spider-Man's Tangled Web. I remember, what is it, Flowers for Rhino, Peter Milligan's homage to... there was also a couple of Darwin Cook issues in there with Jay Bone.
The Valentine's Day one and the Christmas one.
Oh, those were fantastic. Just as sort of one-shot classics. Daily Beagle, I think I mentioned to you.
Yeah, you mentioned
which
that
is a series by Paul Grist. And then I just rediscovered that it was Carl Kerschel who did the art. Carl Kerschel of the Abominable Charles
the
Christopher.
Black and white series,
it was really underrated. It was okay. I felt like, because it was, as you were suggesting.
I remember
suggesting.
Liking it at the time, but... I recently saw it and I thought, this isn't that great.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. But the whole Betty, Jonah.
Betty as a reporter kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, and then Peter sort of running around and you never actually see Spider-Man, but you see the results of his work?
No, it was the whole Gotham Central type of thing. Let's have Daily Bugle without Spider-Man. He's around, but he's not there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what the other people are like. I mean, it's a good idea for a series, but weird that it was in black and white.
Yeah.
And in an experimental format, it would have been more, like, more resonant, I think, if it was in a...
color.
Yeah, in color and in a properly supported series.
And they did kind of revisit it in The Pulse, but I felt like the Jonas stuff actually, they really humanized him. There was a little bit in there about Jonah actually getting back to reporting. Mm-hmm. I think this was the period when he might have given Robert, like Robert Joe took over the editor-in-chief position, so he was just publisher, and then he took to the streets and covered a tenement fire and actually was seeing what it's like to be blocked as a reporter as well by, you know, business interests and all that. Jonah actually seeing the point of view of the little guy after going in and trying to
there was a the Rizzo two-parter with the kingpin and the employee that
from Tangled Web that's right. The was he a boxer or something like that?
Yeah, I don't remember.
I want to say the poster was a boxer. Death of Gene DeWolf, again, Peter David I think was still finding his voice as a writer, but there was on his run there was some really great stuff starting, and a lot of people remembered Death of Gene DeWolf. I think it's not the most even story, but it's hard.
No,
is
I didn't
in the
read
right
it at
place.
The time. I came back later. I know a lot of people love it.
At the time,
not my favorite, really.
But at the time, there was also a fun little in his run, Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man 122, where the art was Romita Sr., John Buscema, Bob McLeod, Mark Teixeira, and again, they're not necessarily on the top of their game in this case, but it was a Rashomon story of a bank robbery told from three different points of view, MJ's, J. Jonah Jameson's, and Peter's, and again, it's not the most even
that
story.
Sounds a lot like, wasn't there an issue of Amazing in the Friends run, or not the Friends run, in the Stern run, that was like that, and it was Jane's story, J. Jonah Jameson's story, and Peter's story. And it was all, like it was, I want to say it was 247 or 249, where it's Jonah is in the club, and he sees the kingpin.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
And Mary Jane, it's her life, actually it might even be earlier in the run, it'd be like the 240s. And it's three different storylines from...
Well, she came back around 250, right? Is that...
No, so she was back around 243.
243, okay.
Yeah, so... she was back on tour, and so there are pictures of her. So this one's her modeling and her lifestyle and thinking about Peter, that kind of thing. But anyway,
guys, I hate to end the party, but I'm gonna have to wrap this up because we're running out of battery and running out of memory.
No problem.
Thank you, guys.
Let's just give a shout out to Bendis and Bagley as well. I know we've only touched about an Ultimate.
Oh yeah,
but
absolutely. That's
I think they deserve mention for sure.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much.
Thank
this has been fantastic. I love talking about Spider-Man with you guys. We're going to do this again.
Collectors rambling for
no. they're literally shutting down. This is what they're shutting down the mall on us. Thank you guys so much, and thanks everybody for listening. Stay tuned to the Cave of Solitude. We will return with more of Sam Noir as well as Kevin Boyd as we head into Fan Expo season.
Phew! We got through it. Thanks again, webheads, for listening. We hope you guys enjoyed the epic Spidey talk that took place between these fine gentlemen, Sam Noir, Kev the Mev. Thank you guys for joining us. Hats off to you. If anybody wants to contact us, you can send us an email at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Also follow us on Facebook, leave a review on iTunes, or on Instagram. We're all over the place. This is Lady J signing off. See ya. Snick, snack, snicked, no, snicked, flip, snicked.
Who has the best rogues gallery? Is it Batman or Spider-Man?
Spider-Man.
Okay.
That's
I agree.
Tough call. I would go with Spider-Man too, because I like the Spider-Man villains more.
Yeah.
I think there's more of a question of who's his greatest villain. Is it Doc Ock? And Superior Spider-Man made me think of that. It made me say,
and maybe not Green Goblin. Whereas with Batman, it's always the Joker.
Yeah, I think there's a well-rounded, as opposed to, you know, here's the Joker at the top and here's everyone else.
What's interesting, though, is the Joker wasn't always the ultimate villain.
No.
No, it wasn't until Killing Joke and Dark Knight Returns that cemented the Joker as the villain.
Yeah.